What's up, everybody? Welcome back. It is MMA After Hours. I am Michael Carlisle alongside Micah Frankel. Micah, how you doing, man?
And I'm doing all right, trying to survive. The back is kicking. The cold weather doesn't do so well with it, so I'm surviving. How about you?
I'm great, man. We got a lot of stuff going on, and I guess we should jump right into the big news. Yeah, well aware, UFC 283 this weekend. We will get you a very in-depth preview on that. We'll look back at Fight Night. But, man, we got tons and tons and tons and tons of news right off the top, because I can't help but feel like we're probably going to differ on our opinions a little bit here. Let's jump right into the news that broke during Fight Night on Saturday, and Dana White confirmed it at the post-fight press conference afterwards. Francis Ngannou stripped of the heavyweight title. He is a free agent. UFC is going to let him walk. They will not try to match any other offers he gets. The title is vacant. John Jones, Cyril gone in March for the vacant title. Let's start with the Ngannou aspect of this, Micah. Surprised at all?
A little bit. A bit surprised. I was overwhelmed by the announcement at first to see gone, to see Jones, to see the reality. That was overwhelming. But to hear that Ngannou was released, it felt academic because we got the fight announcement first. If you would have trickulation of the news earlier that day, right, I really think it softens the blow of the Ngannou news that we have now concrete proof that John Jones is going to heavyweight. He's fighting for the title. And stylistically, he's fighting another guy that commands distance. We can get into everything about that fight. All those emotions of elation, for me at least, overwhelm the thought that Francis Ngannou is gone, that the greatest knockout artist that we've seen, yeah, the guy that possesses the dim mind touch, one little, and you go to sleep, you turn to dust, and your life is over. That's the kind of power this man possesses. But to think about that him and the UFC couldn't come to terms, pretty reasonable. I mean, they were not on good terms. It seemed like this relationship had run its course. It feels like this was never about money. There's respect, and there's also these other aspirations, we'll put it, it feels like, of Ngannou, like boxing, that it feels like are really determining factors that the UFC and Francis don't see eye to eye.
Well, let's not kid ourselves. It's always about money, and money and respect go hand in hand. To your point, and I think you're right, to Ngannou, respect is, I want to go off and box, let me do that. And I don't fault UFC at all. The surprising thing to me here is it took us as long as it did to get to this point. I think it was pretty obvious what Francis wanted, and he wasn't going to bend. It was pretty obvious what the UFC was willing to do and not willing to do. The fact that this drug out this long while Ngannou was out injured, when you could have just did an interim championship, you could have just stripped Francis and crowned a new champ.
Long ago, it's been a year, right?
Yeah, exactly. So from that standpoint, it's a little surprising. I'm going to say something that's going to sound mean, cold, and callous, but I don't mean it that way. But it's a cold, hard reality. Now, we'll get to Francis's side in a second and why this is certainly good for him. From the UFC standpoint, let's be really honest, Micah. This doesn't mean a damn thing. This will not hurt them at all. I like Francis Ngannou. I can respect the hell out of the punching power. I get all that. I understand everything. Nobody's going to miss Francis Ngannou. Nobody is going to miss his one fight a year. Maybe it's a good fight. Maybe it's not, depending on the opponent, depending on the mood. And I don't mean that to shit on Ngannou, but I'm just saying, we all have what we believe is our self-worth. And if that's what you think you're worth, if that's what you think you are, that's fine. But that doesn't mean everybody sees you that way. And right or wrong, fair or not fair, UFC views Francis Ngannou a lot differently than Francis Ngannou views Francis Ngannou. And that's not UFC picking on Ngannou. That's Francis. That's UFC and 99% of the roster.
Do you take Dana at his word? I wanted to get this question to you. That the UFC laid out an offer to Francis that would have made him the highest paid heavyweight ever on the roster.
I don't think Dana said anything that was factually incorrect. Now, does that mean Dana told the truth, the whole truth, and nothing but the truth? Maybe, maybe not.
No, but do you think the offer was legit?
Yes. But what is that offer? Highest paid heavyweight of all time.
Well, how much do you think Lesnar got at UFC 200?
I believe it was between 7 and 8 million. But for that one fight.
Right. Okay, so if the offer is more than that,
eight to 9 million
per fight?
No. My guess is, and this is where I say I don't think Dana said anything that was factually inaccurate. I don't think Dana counts that. And maybe I'm wrong on that. I think maybe Dana would count the last multi-fight contract that Lesnar signed. Or something like that. And a lot's been made about what Dana said. Francis doesn't want to fight top flight competition. Wants to fight Lesnar. Well, yes, and I don't think Francis said, look, I can't fight John Jones. There's no way I'd beat him. Hell no. I don't want to fight Stipe again. He might kick my ass. I don't think Francis said any of that. But I don't think Dana is tricky, because you could say a lot of things that aren't lies or aren't wrong, but they're maybe not the truth either. I think if you look at everything Dana said, and look, I think Dana's connecting some dots and filling in some holes as well, but I think there could very well be some truth to Francis knows he's not getting any younger, not sure how the knee's going to be. He wants to go out and make money. Now, does that necessarily mean he doesn't want to fight the best? No, but let's be honest. If he goes out and fights a boxing match, it's not fighting the top flight competition, right? So, I mean, again, I think there were some sprinkles of truths, but I also don't think for a second Francis Ngannou is afraid to fight anybody. So it's from that standpoint, yeah, Dana said a lot of things that there's some truth to, but I don't think it was the truth, the whole truth, and nothing but the truth.
At 36 years old, the biggest question about Ngannou is the condition of that surgically repaired knee, and he basically didn't have a knee against doctor's orders, fought last year. So maybe he could run off another decade of dominance on one leg in the sport of MMA. Because as much as we love the heavyweights, we're not talking about this crop of prospects flying at you that's breaking down the walls, and we could see the next guy coming. Francis Ngannou is the guy that everyone's been waiting for since Cain Velasquez and Brock Lesnar. We've been waiting for somebody that can look the part, act the part, walk and talk the part, strike fear into the hearts. And now that he put together a wrestling game, it looks like there is a full mixed martial artist. So I wonder, do you feel like there is still an appreciating asset in Francis Ngannou, or a depreciating asset? I understand that the UFC doesn't feel that his worth is what it is, but how do you feel he is just in his career at this point? Is he still ascending, or is there only declining here?
Declining. Now, to be fair, maybe he's still at the plateau. I don't think he's going to ascend any further than he has.
But it could be in the prime. This could just be the peak, and we're going to plateau. The peak,
yeah. I don't know if I'd say prime peak, though. Yes, peak. And look, to be fair, I'm salivating, and I've already worked out the scenarios, how it happens, Ngannou and Fedor. I'm not down on Francis, and I also don't think that fight's going to happen, but I've already worked out in my head how it can.
Do you feel like this is the guy Scott Croker breaks the bank for? Because it sounds like, at least with that Showtime entry to Showtime Boxing, there's a possibility of connection. But heck, we'd be criminal if we didn't say, well, Jake Paul is right there in the PFL. His problem child promotions, top rank boxing. Maybe the PFL pushes all their ESPN chips into, let's do a combined deal with Top Rank to both have Ngannou on the hook.
Nope. If Ngannou does anything other than box Tyson Fury and then retire, I will be shocked. And if I'm Ngannou, that's my very first move. It's look, I'll talk to Bellator. I'll talk to PFL. Hell, I'll talk to ONE Championship. But I've got one goal. That's to go make $25 to $30 million boxing Tyson Fury, and I'm walking away. If I want to stick around after that, win or lose, as long as I don't shit the bed, my value is only going to go up. So I can get more money from these companies who can't offer me as much as UFC could in the first place. So I would be shocked if the first thing we see Ngannou do is anything other than box Tyson Fury.
Yeah, but Francis Ngannou isn't Michael J. Fox. He can't hit a blockbuster with Back to the Future. Because if he could go back in time to last January when he beat Ciryl Gane, when he was on top of the mountain, when he was a hot marketed entity, yeah. Tyson Fury, huge amount of money. It all makes sense. The problem for Ngannou is that after Tyson Fury's last fight, Ngannou's name was not mentioned. The fight previous before that, Ngannou was there. They looked at each other. There was a moment. There was an opportunity, and the knee injury took that away. And now Tyson Fury, it looks like, is in preparation to fight Usyk. Now, I don't know after that fight, after becoming the unified heavyweight champion of the world, if Tyson Fury is going to look around. And then, because that fight's not even fully booked yet, 6 months down the line, a year and a half outside of ever having competed the last time, if he's going to look at Francis Ngannou and say, I'll lift you up, little buddy. I know I didn't mention you for the last year and a half, but I'll bring you in. So I don't know what Francis Ngannou can do to grab the attention of the masses and the public to once again want them to clamor for that cross-sport spectacle.
I don't think Francis has to do anything. And as far as Fury, look, Francis probably is looking at least 6 months but before he'd be ready to do anything anyway. So I don't care about Fury's next fight so much. For Fury, it's one more payday. And from that standpoint, I think he would be interested. But if it, all right, if,
and from that standpoint, he might even say he's more interested in fighting Anthony Joshua. That's a mega fight in the UK. No matter how many fights Joshua loses in a row, that's a bigger fight than Francis Ngannou. I think Francis Ngannou is still behind the eight ball in his next career move.
Okay, if that's the case, Francis Ngannou has made a colossal error,
and that's the gamble that he's making right now.
You asked a second ago, and I didn't quite answer the question. Is this the guy that Scott Coker breaks the bank for? The only way that I see it is if Scott Coker has already maybe picked up that phone, maybe already had that conversation. So Fedor, hypothetically, if you were to beat Ryan Bader, would you be interested? Mega, mega money on a Bellator level, internationally, would you be interested? And here's why I say that. Not saying that that's a must-see fight, but if you're Bellator, are you paying the type of money that is probably going to take to bring in Ngannou to fight Bader? To fight anybody, to fight any other heavyweight currently on that roster?
Well, the problem is you have to, because once he puts Fedor's lights out, inevitably, because that's such a horrendously big puncher to take on a near 50-year-old man.
No, I know.
That then where are you going? You bring in Overeem?
You do, maybe. Well, you do... a one-fight option for a rematch, something like that. I don't think you sign anything long-term. But so if it's not boxing, and this will all tie back in. I'm not skipping around. How much money is Bellator throwing down? PFL? All right, with their new, what's the division? It's the super fight pay-per-view
division, and at least it's a 50-50 pay-per-view split. That could be enticing to an Ngannou, feeling like that's more respect right away. We're 50-50 partners in the business, and he's the headliner. Because if you're the PFL, you do need a second act besides Jake Paul. He's not going to fight four times a year.
I would agree. But what can PFL offer Francis Ngannou fight-wise that's going to draw more than 80,000 pay-per-view buys, and you're getting 50% of that?
Well, that's the same question we asked when they signed Jake Paul, who's now actually looking to go back to boxing in February before he even climbs into the cage. So
They're building a division that is of super fights, not of super weights, I guess. I don't even know how to put it.
But here's why I would tell you. Now, let me be really clear. I'm not talking about talent, anything like that. As a draw, I would tell you Jake Paul is more important to PFL than Francis Ngannou could be.
Oh, yeah.
Because Jake Paul keeps himself
relevant, and Francis Ngannou hasn't been relevant for the last year until this moment.
Right. The other thing, again, who's out there that you could bring in that's going to put butts in seats, sell pay-per-views, sell tickets to fight Francis Ngannou? I mean, it's one thing to go out and fork over the money for Ngannou, but you've got to get a return on your investment.
Well, that's the whole point of everything you just said with Bellator.
Oh, no, I agree.
You got two fights with Fedor, and then what do you do? If you are Francis Ngannou, let's be honest. Let's put it this way. Let's inevitably say, and it's a possibility, let's say that Bader puts Fedor out and Fedor retires. Let's say he fully retires.
Right.
Let's just take him off the board, say that he's going to go away for a year before Scott Croker inevitably talks him into another reunion tour like the Great Band Kiss. Yeah, the Fedor Kiss Tour. What is left for Francis Ngannou?
Nothing.
If Fedor's off the table?
Nothing. And that's the problem. Now, again, Bellator is not above getting creative. Two-fight deal, option for a third. You want to go box, you go box. So if you could squeeze a Fedor fight, or look, hell, I keep selling Ryan Bader short. Ryan Bader looks impressive as shit against Fedor. Maybe you can get a fight there, and depending on what happens, a rematch. But in the meantime, you get something short-term out of Ngannou, and you tell him, yeah, you kind of like with Cyborg. You want to go box? Yeah, go box. That's fine. As long as it doesn't conflict with what we're doing. So... But again, are you willing to pay that money, what Ngannou believes he is worth, to bring him in for a two-match, maybe a trilogy if it all works out against Ryan Bader? No, and I don't mean that as a disrespect to Bader necessarily, but who the hell's plunking down money for that?
Well, nobody. Better question then. Do you think we could see Francis in one or Ryzen?
Maybe at least there you can tap into the international market.
And then it doesn't matter what we think, because exactly. We all think that they're nobodies anyway.
Right. Exactly. Me personally, and my guess would be a lot of American MMA fans, that's not going to excite them at all. But if you can make a shit ton of money in Asia and Europe off of that for one of those companies, that might well be worth it. But that's why I said at the outset, if Ngannou's move is anything other than boxing Tyson Fury, he is fucked up royally.
Well, reason why Ryzen comes to mind is Floyd Mayweather, Manny Pacquiao. If they can throw in Tyson contracts towards that caliber of boxer, they might be having the backing to be in the negotiations with an Ngannou.
The difference there, though, more so Mayweather still at this point than Pacquiao, but you're selling any exhibition Mayweather does off of Mayweather, not who he's sparring with. To a little bit lesser degree, whoever Pacquiao winds up boxing, you're selling that more off of Pacquiao than the matchup. If you're here in the States, now again, we're talking Ryzen, we're talking one championship. Here in the States, I already know the answer, but over there, can you sell an MMA fight based solely off Francis Ngannou?
Maybe.
Here you can't.
Events there just off of Bob Sapp. Remember big of a star he became? And that's why I'm thinking Francis Ngannou is like 100 times what Bob Sapp ever was. He could become in that market. Replacing Bob Sapp, that could be something. Or even one championship, just because they do have Arjunsson Bular versus Anatoly Malkin unifying their heavyweight titles. And if you want to get creative, if you really want to fight and break into the U.S. market, we've talked about that. They're going to need names that make sense to this market. We have DJ versus Marais 3 in May in Denver. But if you're going to expand further out, you're going to need more recognizable talent.
both of those are avenues that I could see them getting in the negotiations. I can't say that I see anyone outbidding Bellator or PFL if they really want to do this.
This is why I said at the outset, I don't think Dana said anything that was technically wrong, even if it wasn't completely right. Because I think we've just laid all this out. If Ngannou wanted to fight the best fights and the best fighters, his only move was staying in UFC. If Ngannou wanted to go out and make money, this was the move to make, at least short term. And by the way, I don't fault him for either one of those. And I also don't necessarily think that means he's afraid to fight anyone, but I can see why Dana would say he didn't want to fight the best competition. If he wanted to fight the best competition, he'd have stayed here. I got all that. Look, here's the other thing for Ngannou. And I realize heavyweights, a little bit longer shelf life most of the time. Realistically, 2 years, especially with the questions in the knee, 2 years, 3 years at a high level, max, at a UFC caliber high level, fighting the Gans, the Joneses, the Miocic's, and what have you. So, and fighting once a year, at most twice, at maybe three times in a 2 year period. You go out and make a quick payday somewhere else.
You mean
quick
the
couple
guy
of paydays?
That was already, what, a sniper or a mercenary in a Fast and the Furious film? Francis Ngannou already has an eye on Hollywood. You're probably right. 3 years, 4 years. We're talking about, what, that? If we get 4 years, we get eight fights out of Ngannou? Hold on. Maybe six?
Hollywood, Francis Ngannou. Do people still watch Fast and Furious movies?
They keep making them, and I heard they're making another one.
So somebody's watching them.
Yeah, there's got to be somebody watching them.
Dude. Francis Ngannou's best bet for Hollywood is they decide to remake the A-Team again, and instead of Rampage, they reach out to Ngannou to play the Mr. T role, the B.A. Baracus. Let's be honest.
Maybe he could do that. I'm honestly not sure if he could end up in the next Black Panther movie. I haven't watched it recently, so I don't know what Usman's role was, but just another big warrior right there. He would seem to fit the physique and the type.
All right, if you're a betting person, what's next for Ngannou? Where and who? I'm not even who, where?
See, I really feel like PFL. I feel like he's going to end up being another crown jewel of that super fight division. They have that $500 million interest, and I feel like they are hungry to try to do something. It's PFL and then Bellator for me.
If he's not boxing Tyson Fury next, he fucked up. Let's say his move is PFL, because, look, I think that's as likely as anything else in the MMA world. Is what little bit more he's going to get worth the step down in exposure, the step down in quality of opponents, as opposed to staying with UFC?
Sometimes you make a stance. Whether that stance in the long term works out for you or not, you make a stance. He was obviously done in this relationship, whatever it was, working with the UFC, and he's went a different way because I don't see that you can go back, that you can listen to other offers and go back. Maybe the UFC is welcome to that, but at this point, they said, we're not matching, just go.
Right, but fighting Jones for the title, even if you lose, there's a rematch there. Fighting Gon again, Stipe again. I get it. He's already fought many of those guys in the division. There's also your Curtis Blades and stuff like that out there. But point being, although he's fought Blades as well, right? He knocked Blades out, right?
Yep. I think twice.
Maybe.
Or was that?
He knocked him out in China. He did. He did because he beat him in Croatia. That was a fight night, a UFC fight night back in 2016. So maybe he felt like, what's left for me here? Even if I stick around, how much of a drawing card can I be fighting the same guys over and over? All right, maybe. I don't know, man. If it ain't Tyson Fury, if it ain't a huge payday, I think I'd have just stuck it out with USC. But again, I'm not Francis. I'm not in that position. I don't know how Francis felt in terms of how UFC viewed him and the whole respect factor and all that. So he's got to do what he feels like is best. But if we're talking strictly business, he damn well better have an inside track on Tyson Fury. Could UFC have been a little more diplomatic in negotiations and worked harder to reach? Yeah, I'm sure they could have. We don't know the ins and outs of all those negotiations, but yeah, I'm 1,000% sure they could have. But the reality is, they could also force him to stick around. They could also hold the right to match any other deal he gets. They're letting him walk away free and clear. Francis wants to go make money. They're allowing him to do that. Now, that doesn't necessarily make, you know, UFC Amnesty International or anything, but they could have been a whole lot bigger dicks about this. And quite honestly, UFC waited around over a year for him to get healthy on the assumption, on the hope that they could work out a new deal, and it didn't work out. They're finally to the point where they're moving on, and they're just letting him walk. And they didn't have to do that. So crap on UFC all you want, and maybe some of it's deserved, maybe it's not. But they could have been a lot bigger dicks here if they had really wanted to. And they'd have been, and maybe dicks isn't even the right word. They could have been a lot more hard-lined if they had wanted to, and they would have been well within their rights to do so.
And I think it's, that is another just glaring reason of how tumultuous the negotiations must have been, that they felt they were that bad, and that there is that much of a desire by Ngannou to leave, that you waive that right to match, and you're like, we don't even want to force them to stick around.
Well,
the UFC isn't just going to do something good. Maybe they feel he's a damaged asset. Maybe they feel he's injured. Maybe they feel he was too hard to work with. Maybe they feel like the price that he was asking was too high and it was never going to be matchable from their checks and balances.
Honestly, I think it's more of they just decided he wasn't worth it. I think they view most of their fighters that way. And look, you're a business. I'm not saying they're wrong. I'm not saying they're right. I'm just saying how I think they view it. Outside of a handful of guys, probably you could probably count that number on one hand. I don't think there are more than four or five fighters, realistically, that it hurts UFC if they don't have any more. And I don't think they considered Francis Ngannou one of them. I don't necessarily think they're wrong either. Now, Francis might go out and prove us wrong, and if he can get a Fury fight, he'll go make a ton of money. But realistically, I mean, seriously, once a year, maybe twice in 3 years, is it worth the hassle? Is it worth the headache? Is it worth the money he wants, the respect he wants? I think they decided it just wasn't, and we'll move along. He can go do what he wants to do. We'll do what we want to do, and people won't care in 6 months.
Yeah.
And okay. And that's just a cold, hard reality of the MMA world. I'm not shitting on it. It's not a bad thing, not a good thing. It is what it is.
Well, to rehash everything we've already said, there's no fights left for Ngannou. He's got like two or three fights. Mm-hmm. He just wants a big payday, and he's probably going to get out anyway. That's really hard to give a fan a reason. I know we only see a fight a couple times a year, but when the allure of Hollywood, when the possibility of retirement is there on every fight, and you're giving the impression that you're not long for the sport, what's the part to invest in?
No, 100%. And again, that's why, look, I don't fault UFC here. I don't fault Ngannou. If I thought I could go make a crap ton of money boxing or PFL or Bellator or Ryzen or somebody is going to throw me a shit ton of money at 36 years of age and a bad knee, and I get it, he fights at heavyweight, but let's not kid ourselves. He's cutting to 265. I don't want to do that anymore. I got to get in. I got to get what I can while I still can. I'm not a young man. I got to get that money. I don't blame anybody here. It's unfortunate. Certainly, I think we would all, in a perfect world, would have preferred he stayed. UFC makes money off of him. He makes money off of them. Just wasn't in the cards.
I don't see anybody doing any blaming. I just know this is business. This is literally the definition of business. They had a negotiation period. It didn't work out. We're moving on. Don't know where he'll be. And to reiterate, you think boxing. I think PFL. That's what we both think is going to happen next for Francis Ngannou.
New champ will be crowned in March. John Jones finally making the move to heavyweight. Surreal Gone, the opponent. You surprised at that at all?
Any move was possible with John Jones. It looked like, because of the recent personal issues that we've previously outlined going on for Stipe Miocic, of recently, just recently, officially putting up that he said goodbye to his father. I think there's a lot going on for him personally that has limited Miocic's ability to focus and to get back into the octagon. We've already talked way too much about Francis Ngannou today. That leaves us with the only possible option, a Surreal Gone. We knew that they were tactically keeping him off the board as that last chip, even though Curtis Blaydes was putting out there was going to be him. We had already talked about commercially the impact that Gon has made. We saw him being entrusted to open up that French market, solidifying him as an international star. So it looks like a logical piece. Am I surprised? I've heard three times now that John Jones' heavyweight debut was locked in. To finally actually see it come to fruition, it's a little unbelievable, yes.
I think, right, with Miocic off the board for the time being, and I think you just alluded to, he's already tweeted out, I want the winner in July. But I think this was the fight to make. Look, I like Tai Tuivasa as much as the next person. That's not the fight. You won't find a bigger Derek Lewis fan than me. Certainly not the fight. The Gon fight was the fight to make. I think it'll be interesting. I actually think Gon presents more challenges than Ngannou would have. Now again, punching power aside, and one punch, he can knock anybody out. I got all that. But I think Gon is a more interesting matchup than Francis would have been for John.
This is the most athletic, biggest, and most technical in his prime fighter that John Jones will ever have fought. All that being said, Gon couldn't stop Ngannou's takedowns. He may be in trouble against the ground game of John Jones, who was submitting black belts before he was even in a gi and was a JUCO national wrestling champion. Again, we don't know the size, the acclimation to the division. We don't know about how Jones is going to react to the size of those punches, to what it really feels like. There's so many questions to be answered. So I could see past the victory for both fighters, and there is no more methodical and more thought out of a heavyweight in the division currently than Surreal Gone. So I do think this is the biggest, most dangerous fight that John Jones could see for his debut in that division, because at least Francis Ngannou, with that surgically repaired knee, was a giant target for John Jones to end his career immediately.
Let me ask you this, and of course we've got the benefit of hindsight. Would Jones have been better served 6-8 months ago, coming back, fighting Marcin Tybura, Chris Daukaus, and then calling his shot? Ngannou, you fight me or give up that title because I'm here for that belt.
No, because you would have made more money off of a Teixeira-Blachowicz matchup. Neither one of those are heavyweight main event worthy on a pay-per-view in Las Vegas or New York. You got to think big for John Jones. We've been waiting for this so long. You're telling me anything outside of the heavyweight title fight, anything outside of a top five name would have done service to John Jones moving up in the division? I mean, Daniel Cormier and Conor McGregor, unfortunately, have kind of set a big bar for guys. Heck, even he sent Henry Cejudo. If you're champ or former champ status and you're jumping up there, it just wouldn't have served the intentions properly to say, I need a warm-up fight of a guy barely in the bottom of the top 10.
Right. Well, yes and no. I get what you're saying, and you may well be 100% right. I was coming at this from, it's one thing when you're moving up other weight classes. It's another thing when you go from light heavyweight to heavyweight. I mean, yeah, technically, you're moving up 5 pounds, but you could be fighting someone who's 210 pounds. You could be fighting someone who's 265 pounds. That is a huge jump up. You brought up Daniel Cormier. Let's not forget, Cormier was a heavyweight before he was a light heavyweight. So he already had experience fighting bigger guys, guys who hit harder, guys who are bigger, stronger, and all that. So that was a little bit easier for him. John, to the best of my knowledge, doesn't have that. And I'm not saying for a second that that John can't do it, because I absolutely think he can. I think that he can. But my point was, get your feet wet in the heavyweight division. You're John Jones, maybe not quite Conor on that level, but you mentioned the quality of opponent. He could have absolutely headlined a pay-per-view somewhere, especially when you were still doing pay-per-views at the Apex. But do that, get your feet wet, make sure you're good at heavyweight. Now, you run the risk, you mentioned lesser opponents. God forbid you lose to a lesser opponent because you're figuring things out at heavyweight. That derails everything, at least short-term, right? So maybe it wasn't the move, but that's why I asked the question.
And for those of us that are wondering what John Jones is going to look like against heavyweights, we know that guys like Cody East and Alistair Overeem, Andre Arlovsky, Marcin Tybura, Dontel Mays, Maurice Greene. I'm just trying to think of all the heavyweights that have come through JW since John Jones has been there. And he trained quite frequently. Well, and here's the thing. There's only two training groups, lightweights and heavyweights. If you're middleweight or bigger, so that's all the way up to heavyweight, you're in that class. So John Jones has been sparring heavyweights his entire career. He's been in there with some big guys that were in the UFC and were in the UFC top 10, two guys that fought for the title. So he does have some of that experience, but it's in the training scenario. We still could see all that go out the window, because the question is, how do you look when you're getting hit for real? Yes, you've been hit in sparring, but how is Jones going to react after all this time? How is it going to look different now, the corner that we haven't seen in action? We know Brandon Gibson is still there. We know that Greg Jackson is still there. Henry Cejudo seems to be added. How will John Jones look at heavyweight? It's a whole mystery.
Did I miss something where John Jones went back to Jackson Wink?
Well, no, but Greg Jackson... Jackson's Akuma, still training at the Jackson gym, still taking photos in the middle of the group, leading it. Wait, who?
Jones. Is he really still at Akuma?
Does he go into the building every morning and have his heavyweight training group that Greg Jackson leads? That's kind of the inclination that we get when he's here in New Mexico. Yes, that building is still where they've been training at. And just recently he headed out to
Arizona
for a few days. And he's been doing that reportedly, I've heard from other people, just every so often. So it's sporadic trips to...
I don't think it's nearly as sporadic as you might think it is.
Like GSP would make trips to Albuquerque for his camp. He wasn't here all the time, but he'd be here a couple weeks at a time then go back to Canada. Maybe that's what Jones is doing.
Okay. Where's John going to do his... speculating. I'm not asking you the answer because you probably don't. John going to do that fight camp here? Or is he going to Arizona and doing it with Cejudo?
I think he's bouncing back and forth because of the bodies that he has here and the striking coach and the game planning with Greg Jackson. And I think there's a lot of things that keep a lot of the guys here currently that Jones is still bouncing back and forth. So I think he's going to be out there for 2 to 3 weeks at a time. Yes. Is there a possibility one day we see some weird video with Henry Cejudo is in Albuquerque for 24 hours to do a whole mind-melding session with all the coaches and look at Jones? Yeah, but would I be surprised if we see a lot of video from Arizona? No, I think it's going to be split pretty diligently. And if you're John Jones and the trouble that he's found in New Mexico at times in Albuquerque, maybe a change of scenery to where you know less people would be a good thing to focus in for a fight camp.
You surprised Cyril Gane opens as a betting favorite against John?
It's a lot of questions about John, a lot less against Cyril. So much time off for John. There's so much potential, but Cyril Gane has proved that he could take a haymaker, and John is not a knockout artist. I think I understand from the power-punching perspective what we've seen out of Gane versus what we haven't seen out of Jones. And the betting lines are there to make money, right?
Yeah. Very true.
Not surprised.
We can be brief on this. Dana White this past week said that he does not anticipate any punishment for the incident with he and his wife over New Year's. Kind of laid out the whole, what good does it do to punish me? Well, you send me home for 30 days. Doesn't bother me at all. Don't pay me for 30 days. Doesn't bother me at all. It hurts the company. Are you tired of the Dana White stuff?
I'm tired of it, but doth thou protest too much? You really think that the wheels absolutely fall off? Okay, so you're telling me that Mick Maynard, Sean Selby, Hunter Campbell, everyone that Dana White has hired and empowered, they suck at their job so much that if they weren't answering to him, they couldn't do the job. The wheels would fall off. The company would be destroyed over 30, 60-day period if he was not there to lead the machine. We really believe that?
To a certain degree. No, is the company, does Dana White show up 60 days later and the building's on fire? And no. Again, I'll bring this up earlier. I said this, you know, when Dana's comments on Ngannou. I don't think Dana's necessarily wrong in what he was saying. Doesn't make him right. His point, to his point, and don't worry, I'm not defending Dana. I'm going to come back around. Just be patient. To his point, sending him home for 30 days, it doesn't do anything to him. 2 months, doesn't do anything to him. It would more adversely affect UFC than it would him. Now, does that mean the wheels fall off? Well, of course not. Having said that, all right, so where do you draw the line? If Dana White's charged with armed robbery, is it still more detrimental to the company to send him home for 2 months than to keep him around if he's charged with murder? So if you're balancing what hurts the company versus what hurts Dana, slapping your wife's not worth sending him home for a month or 2 months because of the damage it would do to the company versus it's not really a punishment for him. So what does he or someone else have to do to where, oh, well, we got to send you home now. We got to part ways. We got to suspend you. You got to go to rehab. You got to do something. I don't think Dana's necessarily wrong, but it doesn't mean that any of that shit is right because, look, punishment oftentimes in sports, especially, that's what we're talking about, so we'll keep it there. It's not even so much about the harm it would do to, it's more about sending a statement. It's more about PR. It's more about showing, hey, we actually care what our people do and things like that. So I think that's where Dana kind of missed the mark with this. I don't think he's necessarily wrong that, well, hell, it'd probably affect UFC more than it affected me if they sent me home. He's probably right, but that doesn't mean it's the right move to make. And that's where I think the issue here is for people who are looking for punishment for consequences for Dana's actions, you're not getting anything. So what would Dana theoretically have to do where Endeavor stepped in and said, you know what? We might just be giving you a vacation here, but you got to go away for 3 months.
Let's not give Dana a vacation. Let's do something else because Dana's like, send me home, suspend me. How's that going to hurt me? I don't want to hurt you, Dana. I don't want to hurt you at all. You have given us the UFC, and that's something beautiful. You created something beautiful. You have this long relationship with your wife that you told us started when you were 12 years old. That's something beautiful. You guys have kids together. You've become millionaires together. That's all beautiful, and we should try to save that. And nothing's going to save that like telling us as a MMA media getting a little too personal and it doesn't hurt me that I'm suspended. What hurts me is that me and my wife have to go to couples therapy now because we have issues we have to work through. We had an incident where substances were abused. I now have to go to alcohol treatment to work on this because obviously something is not going right. And heck, I'm doubling down with it and I'm donating X amount of money to domestic violence. I am doubling down on the code of conduct for UFC fighters. We are making these changes in the company. And I have been told that I have to take these steps of therapy and of addressing the issues that I have that led to this event. And I'm having to work on myself. That's how I am changing myself. And that's how we are working through this situation. And the UFC is totally against domestic violence. And that's why we're donating. Any of those things would be great rather than just saying, well, time away from the company is only going to hurt the company. There are so many other things that you could do, Dana, that are healthy, mature, growing as an individual kind of outlooks on this situation.
So the whole, I've got to go the rest of my life with people thinking I'm a wife abuser, that not really punishment for Dana.
You don't get to name your punishment. I've seen a lot of fighters that were suspended by USADA that have now realized that after they took it, they reflected the next morning, and they are very apologetic about it. And that seems to have served as now they found a harsh enough punishment, and they felt like that would have been good enough, and they should have not been suspended and allowed to continue with their livelihoods. So we don't get to, as a society, name our own punishments, really. I mean, you can finagle deals with the DA and see if a judge will approve it, but I don't think you just get to say, this is my punishment, when there are so many other avenues. Rather than costing this man his job, we're trying to teach him, enlighten him, help him grow as a human. That's what I think would be more appropriate.
I don't disagree with you. Mike, at UFC Fight Night this past week, you had some concerns. Sean Strickland taking this main event fight on short notice. Strickland looked all right on Saturday night.
Oh, holy shnikes, this man threw some low kicks. And did he actually attempt some takedowns?
Yeah.
A tiger changed his stripes. We got some spots in there, people. I mean, little spots of spontaneity. Not able to just be a one-dimensional fighter. And it turned out that the pressure was just too much for Nassourdine Amavov, who, again, last week I gave a huge shout-out to, because going from Gastelum to Strickland is changing night to day. It's changing everything about the kind of fight you expected. He was a huge favorite, and unfortunately, now you suffer a pretty good, handily loss, and Sean Strickland is like, hey, I'm still here in the top 10. His volume, his pressure, a lot of good work out of Sean Strickland. I don't know if this gives us all hopes that he could be a world title holder yet at this point again, but he's not going away without a fight. He's a hard out, and he will wear you out if you don't have the proper game plan to handle what he's doing.
Yep. I thought Dan Ige looked really good in the co-main event against Damon Jackson, and really the co-main and the main were really the only things that stood out to me on Saturday. Look, I was happy to see a friend of the show, Dan Argueta, get the win on the prelims, but to me, that this card was just a welcome back after the holiday layoff.
Man, Ige shutting down the takedown, setting the tone right away, I felt like, with the dirty boxing on the inside, digging to the body, firing hard hooks, feinting, and then firing. And we saw that Jackson, with that pressure, walked right in to that left hook. Mm-hmm. Devastating knockout. Let's give the shout out to Roman Kopylov. That was quite the finish against Apuno Soriano. He was a big underdog himself. Great feints to open up the combinations, and going to the left kick with the body to the body to find the finish. I know you don't want to spend a lot of time on this fight. I'm pretty sure you're going to tell me you don't even give a shit. But did you actually have the scorecards for Pennington or Vieira?
Vieira. I do give a shit. I thought Vieira. I don't think it was a gross miscarriage of justice. I thought Vieira won
that. I thought Vieira did more damage in that third round. Definitely gave her the first one. I thought she should have been on the plus slide of the split. And this is just still kind of more of the muddling for the bantamweight division, where no one can really separate themselves on the women's side. But holy shit, Umar Nurmagomedov, there's nothing else that impressed you. Umar Nurmagomedov, that was stupid, sick, with that knee to the body, had been throwing the left kick, a beautiful switch up, and then brings that straight left down the pipe, putting out Haiani Barcelos. There's another Nurmagomedov that might wear gold in the UFC. Holy shit, that kid's legit.
See, sadly, this is where we're at now, Mike. You expect, if your last name's Nurmagomedov, you expect fighters to do what he did on Saturday. The more shocking thing would have been if he hadn't have done that. And that's probably not fair, but that's how I see it now.
Well, come on. No. I thought we were to the point where they're grinders, they're wrestlers, these hammers. He hit the knee. He had been hitting the front kicks. There's more articulation and striking to the Nurmagomedovs 2.0. And on the prelims, let's give it up to Abdul Razak Alassane. He rebounds from eating a bunch of hard calf kicks in the first round. Big right hand counters for the knockout of Claudio Ribeiro. Matthews Robecki with the, or it's Robeski, excuse me, Robeski.
pretty impressive, I thought, for a debut, getting his feet wet. 17-1, came in there, landed some big strikes, sowed some dominance on the ground. Alan Ostamento gets a black belt and gets a rear naked choke. That's what happens. In training, they give you the black belt, and then all of a sudden you hit the octagon, and you're now in submissions left and right. You mentioned it, Dan Argueta, the determined one, sweeps the scorecards. Nothing but suffocating offense and groundwork from Argueta. Love to see how he's improving. And Charles Johnson, I thought it was great the way he was able to attack the body, killing it with teep kicks, and able to reverse Jimmy Flick every time that Flick went for the takedowns. Huge ground and pound to get that first round TKO. So you weren't impressed, but there was a lot of stuff on this card that I really loved.
Well, good. No, look, I don't think it was a bad card. It was...
Whatever. It was lacking some names, but yeah. I thought there was a lot of excitement.
Yep. Before we get to our UFC 283 preview, Micah, I know you got a ton of news.
Oh, well, we also had an LFA card this past weekend. Real quick, want to mention that we saw Thomas Peterson, the first round TKO of Richard Foster. Peterson could be on his way to the octagon. We need more heavyweights. Mark LaMacco, a flyweight name to keep... in the wallet. Remember that one. Suffocating ground game in his own right. Jalen Fuller, friend of mine, interviewed him pre-fight. Big finish, getting the power guillotine. Couple strikes landed. Scott Wirtz goes right for the takedown and gets choked out quickly. Full results, full recap up at cagedminds.com. And now we have a whole shite ton of announcements for you. The UFC's 284 card, Joel Alvarez is out. Zubair Tuglodulov is going to be facing Elvis Brenner, who's making his octagon debut. Austin Lane is going to be taking on Junior Tafa, that one at heavyweight. Those are both, again, February 11th, UFC 284. Ramiz Brahima, Carlton Harris at welterweight, and Jordan Wright, who I've interviewed several times, against Zach Baunga at light heavyweight, are additions to the February 18th UFC fight night at the Apex, I believe. John Jones, Cyril Gane, we said it, it's official, UFC 285, March 4th. 2 weeks later, it's official. Leon Edwards, Kamaru Usman 3 headlines UFC 286. The welterweight title is on the line. Excited to hear about that trilogy?
Absolutely. I also think Usman probably gets his title back. We'll talk more about that as we get close to it. Real quick on the subject of that card, anyone holding out hope for Paddy Pimblett to find his way on that card? Probably not going to happen. Paddy, ankle, I believe it is, and says he's going to need surgery, so...
Ooh, Muhammad Mukhaev versus Jafel Filho in the flyweight division. Justin Gaethje versus Rafael Fiziev in the works for the card, not official yet. Veronica Macedo, who recently, I believe, married Dan Hardy, yeah, former UFC analyst. She's going to be taking on Juliana Miller, the tough winner. That one's a women's flyweight bout. Chris Duncan versus Michael Figlock at lightweight, and Gunnar Nelson versus Daniel Rodriguez at welterweight. Those are all additions to UFC 286. That card stacking up nicely. They're bringing in Gaethje and Fiziev, so they're struggling to get the local talent on that card, but that one's a banger, I feel like. We also have Steven Peterson, Lucas Alexander at featherweight, and Alex Caceres, Nate Landwehr. Featherweight additions, UFC San Antonio, March 25th. I like both those fights. I can feel like that Caceres-Landwehr one, that's going to be an interesting clash of styles with the karate of Caceres and just the nasty, nasty one to get into it of Nate Landwehr. Michelle Waterson is going to be back in the octagon. UFC 287, April 8th. Heard that one is going to be in New York. She's taking on Luana Pinheiro. We have Carla Rosa versus Norma Dumont at April 22nd's UFC event. And yeah, Francis Ngannou released. We got some LFA news for you guys. LFA 152 taking place February 10th. That's going to be the Grand Event Center in Shawnee, Oklahoma. Hinato Valenete, Azamat Bekinov, top Brazilian and Russian middleweight prospects in that main event. And then on February 17th, Hammond, Indiana, the Horseshoe Casino have LFA 153. The main event, Chepe Matascal versus Guilherme Ferreira, the former XFC champion, Oscar, who was once signed to the UFC and was released without ever fighting, takes on Matthias Silva. And two guys I've had the pleasure to interview, Josh Streaker and Edwin Cooper Jr., stellar prospects, are both on that card. Bellator made some announcements last week, too. Big ones. We know we need a Grand Prix every year. They teased us it was going to be 155, and now it's official for the lightweight division. Kicking off March 10th, Bellator 292, Usman Nurmagomedov. Another Nurmagomedov wearing a belt. Yes, he's going to be in his first title defense as a Grand Prix quarterfinal against Smooth Benson Henderson. And Taufiq Musayev versus Alexander Shibley, your other quarterfinal happening on that card. Bellator is heading back to Paris on May 12th. The Accor Arena main event is a middleweight number one contender's bout. The former champion, Gegard Mousasi, taking on Fabian Edwards. Yes, the brother of Leon Edwards, who I got to talk to at a UFC weigh-in there in Salt Lake City right before his brother fought. And the other announced fight for that card is also a quarterfinal Grand Prix in the lightweights as Sydney Outlaw takes on Mansoor Barnyani. And at some point then, that means we'll get our other quarterfinal in the Grand Prix this year. And that one's going to see Patricky Pitbull Freyde, AJ McKee, I guess Bellator, even though they made the Freyde and McKee family be teammates in Japan, they're not letting that family rivalry grow until AJ fights both brothers. There's your news for this week.
All right, Micah, UFC 283 this Saturday should be a good one as well from Rio de Janeiro. Two title fights on top of this card, the light heavyweight title, the vacant light heavyweight title, Glover Teixeira, Jamahal Hill. We also get the flyweight title, Deiveson Figueiredo, Brandon Moreno, the main card especially, but even the prelims. A lot of good things on here, but this main card really stacked. First pay-per-view of 2023 for UFC, and it should be a good one.
Who do you favor in the main event? I before I even break it down, who do you favor? Who's your first instinct, inclination?
Jamahal Hill.
Why Jamahal Hill?
He's younger.
Why do you think that makes such a difference in this matchup?
Because I think Teixeira looked old at the end of the Yuri fight.
How do you look at the beginning?
Pretty good.
Here's everything. The betting line agrees with Mr. Michael Carlisle. A minus 125 favorite for Jamahal Hill.
I had not even seen the betting line. You're right. Look, I'm still going to pick Teixeira. I just don't feel good about it.
Well, this is what I started thinking as I'm looking at the raw numbers. Uh-huh. Okay, Teixeira, 18 knockouts, 10 submissions. He's won 6 of his last 7. Yep. Hill, 7 knockouts, a 3-fight win streak. All knockouts. Well, 2 knockouts in the first round, but they've all been knockouts. He didn't look great, though, as I'm watching the Thiago Santos fight. And I'm wondering, was it the surprise of the takedown from Thiago Santos that was giving Hill troubles at points in that fight? Or was it the fact that he hadn't been tested against elite-level fighters in that area? You got to commend Hill for taking his training camp to work with Anthony Smith, great UFC analyst, light heavyweight, deeply analytical. Weren't they supposed to fight each other, actually? And now they're training partners.
Yeah.
Either way, if Glover Teixeira gets takedowns, that's usually a recipe for him to be victorious. To my surprise, when you rewatch the Prochaska fight, Teixeira is heavily a wrestler. I don't know if it all adds up perfectly. If Hill's going to be able to stop the takedowns of Teixeira, who, if you look back at the end of the Prochaska fight in the fourth round, I believe there's a big right hand that rocks Prochaska. That power is the last thing to fade. If this is a marathon, I can understand the trepidation. But in those early rounds, if Teixeira is able to attack the takedowns and we're downhill, he may be able to find a submission. All that being said, yes, maybe this is the point where we see an old Glover Teixeira. He's in his 40s. Hill has killer power out of both hands. He could pull off the victory. I'm more surprised, though, to see that the former champion isn't the favorite. I thought I was going to have to be talking people in to Jamahal Hill as an underdog, not trying to remind people the greatness of Glover Teixeira, how he was able to dig down deep, how, yes, he was beaten up at points by Jiří Procházka, but there's a lot of differences. Well, there is unique ways that Hill launches his hooks and places his boxing combinations. There's not the threat of the jumping knees, and there's just a lot more unorthodox techniques you have to worry about with Jiří Procházka, where you're going to see a lot more fundamental striking out of Hill.
I think it's a really interesting matchup. And like I said, my pick would still be Teixeira here. I don't feel good about it. But we'll see. I think it's going to be a very good fight either way, as is the co-main event. Flyweight title on the line. Davison Figueiredo, Brandon Moreno meeting for the 47th time, Micah. Can you believe that?
It's not the 63rd?
No, I think it's just 47. In all honesty, it's what, the fourth time?
Fourth time. Yeah. First quad trilogy.
Yeah, dude.
Technically a title unification bout.
Right, yeah, because Moreno is technically the interim champ, right? Yeah.
We have Davison Figueiredo, 9 knockouts, 8 submissions, but hasn't fought since last January. Well, Moreno, he did beat Kai Kara France in July, or was it June, something like that. It was over the summer. He won the interim title, the massive body kick. It's 4 knockouts, 11 submissions. If you look at Moreno between the two fights, if you look at the adjustments that he made, the fighter, the stance, the tactics that he was employing in the rematch last year, 1 year ago, UFC 270, I believe it was, versus the form that he was in against Kai Kara France, it's kind of night and day. There's much better hand positioning. You actually see some chin tucked. And what you saw was a change of stance to a little bit more upright and more of a boxer in that second fight, and a little more sturdy on his stance, where he was so free-flowy, it would almost make you wonder if two or maybe all three of the knockdowns that he suffered in the fight weren't contributed from just being off balance, trying to be too flowy in the moment. And you got to credit the tutelage of a guy that maybe in federal prison recently for a lot of those changes that Moreno underwent. How has that progression continued now under the tutelage of Saif Saud? How different of a Brandon Moreno are we going to see? Because we saw a much improved version from that trilogy fight to this fight, which makes you suspect Moreno is the guy that you could trust to have evolved in this time. I don't know if you've watched. I haven't been paying attention to Davison Figueiredo's social media. I'm not sure I would believe that he did the majority of this camp in Brazil.
Yeah, I believe he did.
Back in Arizona? How much influence did he have from Henry Cejudo? Because I believe that the team Cejudo was a positive influence on Figueiredo and made positive improvements from the inaugural fight to that trilogy match that got him the belt back. So I tend to favor Brandon Moreno heading into this one.
That's the way I'm leaning as well. I do have some questions, as far as changing up things with camps and all that, how that's going to affect him, if it does at all. Hell, it might wind up. It could wind up being a positive for Moreno, though. We'll have to see how it plays out. And the odds are that they're both minus 110, so this is pretty much a pick 'em. I do like Moreno here. Maybe it's because I'm kind of looking forward to the fifth fight between the two, and I think Moreno winning gets us there more quickly than Figueiredo winning. I don't know, but I do like Moreno here.
Moreno wins, Figueiredo loses and moves up to 135. I just can't get out the thought of my head from the third fight.
Yeah.
Moreno's punches had such impact on Figueiredo that he was moving away. I thought that Moreno had more left in the gas tank, but again, being off balance, he got knocked down twice in one round, got flattened in the fifth round. It was hard not to just go 1-3-5 for Figueiredo when you saw the flying around the octagon that some of those moves happened to Moreno, the impact?
Real quick, because I like chaos.
You want to draw again?
No.
That's how we get a fifth fight, is a draw.
Oh, no. Yes.
Because if
yes,
you won, fifth fight. Two.
No, this is better chaos. Figueiredo misses weight. I'm sorry. That choked you up that much? Figueiredo missing weight? Come on, man. Jesus Christ.
I can't drink water. My apologies.
Yeah. Figueiredo misses weight. Moreno's the only one who can win the title. Figueiredo wins the fight. He's not the champ. But Moreno's the interim champ. Who's the champ?
He's stripped if he misses weight.
Right.
So and he can't Moreno win. Moreno is the champion because he gets both belts.
But Figueiredo wins the fight. Yeah, right.
Wins the fight.
See, you were still over there choking. Right.
Sorry. Okay.
Figueiredo misses weight, so he's stripped. He can't win the title. Moreno can.
So you're telling me
But Figueiredo beats Moreno. Who's the interim champ? Figueiredo doesn't win the interim championship, obviously. But all of a sudden, that title's vacant, but you've got a interim champ.
It just never ends.
Yes.
It just never ends.
Yes. That's what we should all hope. No, I'm kidding. We should not hope for that. But be that as it may, it should be a good one. Rest of this main card, Gilbert Burns and Neil Magny.
Do you think Magny can pull off the upset here?
Can he? Yeah, sure. Will he? Nope. Not a chance.
Improbable. I would say that one. It's highly improbable.
Shouldn't
minus
say not a chance. Yeah.
Minus 365 favorite. Let's be honest. There is a division because this is top five against, this is 5 against 12, and that's how much of a difference there is. That's how much respect you got to give to Gilbert Burns. Stood in front of the power punching of Khamzat Chimaev. Chimaev wanted nothing to do with a grappler of that credential. I don't know how Magny finds great success with a Burns who is so willing to get into the fire and make crazy fights. It's almost more eye-opening to see that Andrade, number 6 against number 4 Lauren Murthy, is a minus 450 favorite in Brazil. The betting odds, the makers are feeling that Miss Andrade is a iron lock against a Lauren Murphy that is a consummate underdog, comes at you, can outwork, put it on Miesha Tate in her last fight. But when we see a phenomenal on top of it Jessica Andrade, she's probably one of the top 5 or 6 female fighters in MMA, hands down. Her losses are to names like Wei Li, Shevchenko, and Nama Yunus. I'm going to be like everybody else probably. We're all underestimating Lauren Murphy and not really sure where she shows a path for victory. But if she lands hard enough, maybe she stuns Andrade, and then everything changes.
Maybe. Kicking off the pay-per-view, Paul Craig, Johnny Walker, numbers 9 and 12 in the light heavyweight division.
There's no way this fight goes outside of a round. It's like 4 or 5 of his last 6 fights for Johnny Walker, win or lose, and in the first round. And Paul Craig, well, every one of his fights is just crazy shit. He pulls off submissions. He just gets in these unorthodox positions. What kind of Johnny Walker do we see? Where did he train? Who did he train with? The guy is constantly training, changing up so much. I know that he was recently married. Hopefully, we see the Johnny Walker that is the phenomenal fighter. We saw a return to that against Ian Kuntilaba. But Paul Craig is able to get in there, muck stuff up, and come away with submissions.
I think that'll be interesting. Last time we saw Johnny Walker, wasn't he wandering around the streets of Vegas still in his fight gear?
After a victory, yeah. After getting back. He was wandering across the street, it looked like.
Yeah.
I thought he was supposed to be, at least.
Yeah. It should be interesting. Now, as far as the prelims go, Mike, what stands out for you there?
Well, we got the swan song, the fond farewell to Shogun Hua. Shogun 2-2-1 over his last 5 fights. He does have wins over Tyson Pedro and Little Nog right there. Taking on an Igor Pretoria, who, nameless to most UFC fans, I think the UFC is doing what they can to give Hua that moment he's looking for. Pretoria lost by knockout in his UFC debut to Nick Mariano, and now is getting such a spotlighted fight. This is hopefully that moment that the Brazilian crowd is looking for. Gregory Rodriguez, this one is interesting. 4-1 in his 5 fights in the UFC. The one loss is a controversial split decision to Armin Petrosian. He feels like he's on a win streak, gaining some momentum, and for some reason he's welcoming the 9-0 Bruno Fiera to the octagon. Bruno, 6 knockouts, 3 submissions. We'll see what he has to offer. I've never seen him fight before, so there must be something if you're getting Rodriguez that's coming off of back-to-back knockout wins. 5 of his last 6 wins are knockout. The guy seems like somebody that's been improving. He's been a fun watch to get this kind of opportunity for Fiera. Signals to me they think he's something special. We have in the lightweight division, Michael Costa. I know him because I tell you guys about the LFA all the time. Watch the LFA. You're going to see the guys making their UFC debuts. Costa has multiple skill set. He's coming in on short notice. He's won 7 of his last 8, but he's taking on a Thiago Moises, who is very physically strong, a tight jiu-jitsu game, and an above-average striking game. He's not elite level, but he's very good. This might be too much on a debut on short notice, but it could also turn out to be a fight of the night. Shamil Abdurmagomedov versus Jailton Almeida in the heavyweight division. Almeida was going to be a light heavyweight, now seems to have fully acclimated himself to the heavyweight division. The 12-fight win streak, 3 first-round wins in the UFC, 11 wins by submission. Abdurmagomedov is on a 3-fight skid, but does have wins over Chase Sherman, Marcin Tybura, and Andre Arlovsky. Look for that one to be a grappling special. More guys from the LFA on this card. Gabriel Bonfim taking on Menor Lazaez in his octagon debut. Bonfim has 10 submissions, 3 knockouts, 6 first-round submissions, an exciting fighter. Lazaez, 2-1 in the UFC. Both his wins are by decision, but on the regional scene, he did have 8 wins by knockout. Triple L, Luis Lacerda, making his UFC debut, also coming off the LFA 10-fight win streak, 6 wins by submission. In that span, has 10 subs overall. He's taking on a Cody Stammen, who saved his career, ended a 3-fight skid by knocking out Eddie Wineland. Remember, one time, Stammen was a guy knocking on the door of contention. He was fighting Aljamain Sterling. He was on main cards. He's a wrestler that's putting together his hands, but we don't know if we've already seen the best of him. Ismael Bonfim. Yes, Gabriel's brother is on the card taking on Terrence McKinney. Bonfim, a 12-fight win streak, 8 knockouts, 4 submissions. Terrence McKinney, quite possibly the most exciting one-round fighter in the whole UFC. 5 knockouts, 8 submissions, 3-1 in the UFC, and they've all been stupid exciting. We have a women's featherweight bout, yes, on the card. Josanna Nunez is 9-1. She has 4 wins by knockout and is 0-2 somehow in the octagon. Well, on the other side, or excuse me, is 2-0 in the octagon. Well, Fiera Zahar, her opponent, has lost both of her UFC fights. So we'll see that one. And one more exciting one for the local fans. You have Daniel Marcos from Peru. 7 wins by knockout, 13-0. Taking on Brazil's Simon Oliveira. Looking to bounce back from a debut loss to Tony Gravely that ended a 7-fight win streak. He has 11 wins by submission.
UFC 283 this Saturday for Rio de Janeiro. That is 10 p.m. Eastern time for the main card on ESPN Plus or wherever you get your pay-per-views. Before you wrap up, Mike, I know we've got some other stuff. We got some Invicta this weekend, right?
Not this week. This week.
Yeah.
Wednesday night, the light. Get some fights in on your hump day. Wednesday night, Access TV. It's Invicta FC 51 from Real Works in Denver, Colorado. At the top of the card, you do have the main event, women's bantamweight title fight, Tisha Tennant defending against UFC vet Talita Bernardo. Look out for Tennant. We need new blood in the women's bantamweight division. She's won the title. She's going to defend the title. She could be on the cusp of getting that call up. And the vacant flyweight title also on the line, Christina Williams, Bellator vet, taking on Brazil's Caitlin Souza. You got a couple other familiar names on that card, like Olga Rubin. She's fought against Cyborg. So check out the card. Wednesday night fights, Access TV.
Anything else we need to hit on, Mike? I can't help but feel like we solved all the world's problems in today's episode.
We've solved all the world's problems, and we might see just how they work out for Francis Ngannou. That's still the biggest question of all of them.
I would agree. Mike, tell everybody how they can keep up with you.
The website is cagedminds.com. Go over to the YouTube channel. That's Caged Minds MMA Show. Because we have a whole ton going on here locally. Local Minute, Albuquerque Minute here real quick, guys. We're here in New Mexico. We do have boxing coming up February 4th. Whole ton of interviews up on the website and the YouTube channel about that event. Then we take a week off and Knuckle Mania, Bare Knuckle FC's biggest event of the year, is going to be here in New Mexico, Tingley Coliseum. And you have some great names on that card. The main event is a light heavyweight title unification bout. Mike Richmond, the interim champion, against the champion, Lorenzo Hunt, who also holds the BKFC cruiserweight title. That's your main event, co-main event. I think it's the biggest crossover matchup that BKFC has ever done. It's Diego Sanchez versus Austin Trout. This is a step up for me from Malinaji versus Lobov. Let's be honest. Lobov never fought for the UFC title. Diego Sanchez did. Malinaji was a bit further out of his boxing career than when Trout did. Trout still fighting around the world, still winning. So this fight, I think, takes that to another level, not to mention John Dotson taking on Jared Grant, the former BKFC interim champion. Bantamweight title is vacant. Dotson wants his hands on that one. His little brother, Eric Dotson, is on the card. Jamie Hinshaw's back for a second time. Josh Moreno. All kinds of stuff going on with that BKFC card. I'm looking forward to it here locally. And we got more boxing a weekend later at the Rio Rancho Event Center on February 24th. Never thought I'd say these words. We're going to see Tiller Fight Club here locally. It's going to be a Tapia Fight Night co-promoting the event there. So some local flavor from a legend with that Tiller Fight Club bringing in most of the card. Something special there that you'll see. We're going to have all the coverage. The social media is a good place to look for it. Facebook is Caged Minds Combat Sports News. The Instagram is CagedMinds_CSN. And Twitter at CagedMindsMMA.
You can find the show on Twitter at MMA After Hours. You can get me at Real Mike Carlisle. Email us MMAAfterHours@gmail.com. Enjoy UFC 283. We will talk to you next week right here on MMA After Hours. You're on the After Hours Podcast Network.
Love combat sports? I have a website for you, cagedminds.com. That's CAGEDMINDS.com. Fight news from around the world, in-depth interviews, live event coverage. Covering combat sports for over a decade. Established in April 2011. That's cagedminds.com.